No introduction needed.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. That's just recording, Mike?
Yes.
Okay. I was asked to give a little Dhamma talk tonight. And for those who don't know me, I'm from Canada, Ajahn Sona, been here recently, and I recognize many of you, so glad to be here. We're here for the ordination of the three novices from Birken Monastery. And auspiciously we arrived at the Uposatha and were able to participate in that. It's been a little while since I sat in with so many monks and had the full Patimokkha recited. It's a very nice feeling. And when we return, we will have now three new bhikkhus and a full quorum at Sitavana or Birken Monastery. We have two names now. A secondary name in Pali, Sitavana, meaning a cool forest monastery. Very appropriate for Canada. And so we will be reciting the Patimokkha in full now, part of the great tradition, with a full entourage of monks. We will also be able to, if we have five monks in residence through the rainy season, we will be able to have a katina at the end of it. So it's a nice opportunity to welcome new Sangha members. And also, it was particularly a pleasant surprise for me to kneel down tonight and have the opportunity to recite the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. We do it, and it's an evergreen, and it goes through various cycles of popularity at the monastery over the last few years. We haven't done it for quite some time, but it was nice to hear this many voices chanting it. Also, chanting it with the correct rhythm and pronunciation. And also, it was good to hand me something to talk about. So, I mean, these are a type of talks as you travel around and so forth. You just get invited sometimes to talk. And I've given up preparing anything because I just hope that... I imagine by now that there's enough contents rattling around in my head. And I like to kind of not plan it too much because if you do, you kind of sometimes ignore what's actually relevant and spontaneous and meaningful to this moment. So it's nice to leave it planned. Also, I don't get so bored because I get to listen to what I have to say and it's all new. I haven't done a lot of rehearsal. Anyway, this is the... This monumental sutta, the first given formally to the Buddha's comrades from his misspent youth, the misspent 7 years in the wrong direction, but probably necessary. I don't know whether perhaps more than this just happening to the Buddha, that this idea of extremes of finding the middle path, it happens in a microcosm in various people's lives. Certainly in my life, I have gone to extremes, And it's been a helpful and learning experience to find out where the middle is. I've also passed my 20th reign this year, and part of that was that I end up giving some talks on 20 years in the robes. And just before I came down in Vancouver, I gave a talk at the public library there, a very nice room. And I had planned once again to talk about the last 20 years, but I actually never made it to the first year. I ended up talking about I started at 15 and the talk was over before I got to the first year of my ordination. So, but one thing that that came up was the exploration as I moved into a kind of a Buddhist view of things, my interest in simplicity and finding out what I didn't need, etc. I end up, I suppose, intuitively moving towards Dhamma, and also, of course, having some explicit ideas about monks and so forth. But I end up doing a lot of winter camping. And exploring the extremes of both indulgence and minimalism, or perhaps hyper-minimalism. And only in retrospect as I came across the teaching of the Buddha, did I realize I kind of repeated a paradigm or a kind of pattern in human nature. Looking back, I spent some time, I think it was an aspiration first to get away, to get out of the confusing, claustrophobic nature of a urban cultural life, just to get out in the woods, to clear the mind. I can just see that the Buddha again, or the Bodhisattva at the time, going over the wall of the palace into the forest, and not with a sense of destiny necessarily, although some schools perhaps reinterpret the idea that he was only kind of going through the motions, that he was already so deeply enlightened and everything that he had to do this as a demonstration to the world. I've never been very impressed by that idea. I really think he didn't know what he was going to, but he knew what he was going away from. That's not the best way to travel through life. I often give the advice to people, don't just go away from things, go towards things. But the Bodhisattva, how could he, in a sense, or perhaps unconsciously, be going towards something, but certainly consciously, just knowing what he was going away from. And obviously because of this pursuit of extreme asceticism in the following 6 years, he didn't have a clear vision at the beginning. And so it reminded me of these endeavors that I went through as well, of starting off trying to drag all the comforts of life along on an expedition into the Ontario winter at 40 below zero, which makes a lot of weight. And so much weight that we couldn't put it on our backs. It had to be dragged on a toboggan. And I think we made it about 3 miles on snowshoes, dragging toboggans across 40 below zero. And neither of us had been camping for a long time. So it was an interesting thing. We took everything plus the kitchen sink. And of course, the whole, looking back on it, the whole weight of this, the weight of it, and part of the dragging of this weight was part of the problem, the ultimate attempt to provide everything, every possibility, ultimately led to some failures. And so after managing to struggle all this way, of course, soaking wet with sweat, which is not a good idea at 40 below zero. And then equipped with triple backup for eating and so forth, the high concern, the theory that you needed a lot to eat at this kind of temperature. So we started with, well, now we make a little camp, and first thing is a fire. So we had brought an axe and a saw and the whole business. I took the axe, went for some firewood, floundering around in snow, trying to chop a tree down. One swing, axe head comes off, disappears into the snow forever. Because of the cold, everything shrinks, the axe handle shrinks, everything shrinks, and it just flew off. And we spent, half an hour of the precious remains of daylight searching up to our shoulders for the axe head, and not finding it, and getting progressively colder and colder and colder. Ani out of desperation, but we had triple backup. So we had a Coleman stove with a propane canister. And if you're a physicist, you'll know already that propane at 40 below zero, canisters have no pressure in them. So, and my friend happened to have a master's degree in physics engineering, and he could explain the whole thing to me, but he hadn't thought about it beforehand. So why our stove didn't work, he knew exactly why. So now we're down to a can of Sterno. We had brought along some food, of course, filet mignon, raw filet mignon. Have you ever seen a hockey puck with bacon wrapped around it? That's what it was. And of course, completely inedible, and the Sterno didn't even melt snow. So all of the things, we had nothing left except to eat snow and go to bed. So we had a huge tent with us, very bulky. We managed to set it up. And heeding all these kind of books we'd read about winter camping, my friend decided that he must get rid of his wet clothing, get dry clothing on. And in order to do this, he has to strip down at 40 below zero in this tent with a gas lantern hanging in the middle of it. The only thing that worked, a pump-up gas lantern. And in his frantic efforts, he knocked that down and broke it and set the place on fire. And he was stark naked. Shards of glass and jet fuel and flames. And however, we managed to put it out. Now we're in the pitch black, broken glass, frigid snow. Anyway, we did survive till dawn, and you could see two lonely figures trudging back the 3 miles the next day with toboggans loaded. Wiser but sadder men. And it was the beginning of an evolution. We analyzed what went wrong, and the attempt to make it all safe and cozy and everything was the cause of the incredible discomfort and so forth. So began to gravitate down towards, from the overindulgence and the burdens that one carries from this kind of thinking. The thinking was all wrong. It seems so reasonable in a warm house in Toronto. But that's also part of something that I discovered as we went along, and slowly we made vast improvements the next trip, the next trip, the next trip. And then we began to think that there's a magic key that we will just go, how light can we go? So not that long afterwards, we're down to just no sleeping bags, no tent, and just bread in your pockets of a plastic raincoat from Honest Ed's, and November in Ontario. And so we got out there and started to snow. And we came to a place, although, you know, it was really not as bad as the first trip with all the overindulgence. At least we... So anyway, lay down to sleep in the open with the snow coming down on us and wrapped in plastic raincoats. And woke up in the morning, both of us frozen feet, covered in 6 inches of snow. Had to walk about 20 kilometers to just get our feet warm, you know, to feeling in our feet. And so we came to the realization we'd gone too far in the direction of trying to be light. What we were really trying to do is like get rid of all burdens so they not have anything to carry or to, you know, burden us. And so we realized, though, that that was an extreme that didn't work. And so we made our way back to this. And then we started to realize the pattern. We even started to talk about the Buddha. We say, this is weird, you know, this must be what the middle path is, like this extreme we went to. We just went off the deep, you know, too far. So we moved back into and found that just that right amount. And trying to find that with wisdom. The other thing that we discovered was that our thinking could not be trusted when we were trying to make plans for any of these things in a warm house. That you couldn't be realistic about things. You didn't prearrange anything. You thought, well, I'll do this out there, you know, if it was tying knots and things like this. But when you get out there at 30 below zero, 40 below zero, you can't tie knots. Somehow this doesn't seem real when you're in a pleasant environment. It only seems real out there. So what we decided was we would take a little notebook along and write down our thoughts in the middle of the camping trips, and that we would consider this to be kind of a sutta or a Bible. And not, it must be followed literally and completely and in detail and cannot be questioned, especially in a warm living room. So we took it back, and it was very interesting opening the thing, reading it before in a prep for the next trip. And thinking, oh, well, do we really have... But remember the override clause. You must follow this. These are the rules. Because they were made in reality. They're made in the midst of the situation where the truth is apparent. And so when we did this, we found that when we went out with taking the advice of the book, that everything worked just fine out there. So that's another lesson that we kept learning, the realization of the nature of delusion, that just you cannot trust your mind in certain situations. It's only in this particular situation where in contact with reality that you can see. And this I discovered again and again, is that the maze of the mind, when can you trust what it says, when can you not trust what it says, and that contact with reality. And I've come to use that a lot with people come to me with all these problems all the time and want advice, and I'm again and again telling them that this problem is not really one that you need to solve. This problem is one you need to dissolve. And that the nature of most problems are strange nature of the mind. The evolutionary dysfunction that the mind is a source of problems. It creates the problems, and many of them are not necessary to solve, but they are the problem. The mind itself generating problems is the problem. And cannot be the one that solves the problem. And that is that you've got to find yourself in the right place when can you trust what the mind says? When can you trust the mind? And the only time you really can trust it is in this some condition of serenity. It doesn't have to be profound, but it has to be noticeably serene, so that one evaluates one's capacity to solve or dissolve problems not by the quality of thought, but by the texture of feeling. The direct experience of the equanimity, serenity, and if it's not, if you don't know whether you are serene or not, you're not. And so if it's not there, almost everything you think is useless, not to be trusted. If it is there, then that voice really can be trusted, and usually what it tells you is that your life is really simple, that it's not complicated. And that's something as well to learn, is that when you talk to yourself about your life, it's not just a matter, you're not really just recounting the facts. You're actually giving yourself a lot of suggestions. And if you talk to yourself that you have a lot of things to do, a lot of burdens, duties, and that your in-laws take up a lot of your life, etc., you are not just giving an accurate portrait, but you are suggesting things to yourself, and it becomes real. And so if you're going to talk to yourself at all about it, you should always talk to yourself. Even if you feel it's somewhat false, you are profoundly suggesting something, and that is to talk to yourself about how simple your life is. How really it's not that bad. It's quite easy. You don't have that many complex things to do. In fact, most of them are really simple. Most of them involve walking across rooms, sitting on chairs, lifting cups of tea or coffee, writing things down perhaps. When you look at that through a silent camera, the activities of a human, turns out it's fairly simple, fairly straightforward. And when you're talking to yourself like that, then you are not only probably closer to an accurate description of reality, but also you're suggesting. Of course, we can make complexities out of anything. If you're inclined to this, you will find, much to your surprise, perhaps even if you go off to a monastery and spend some time and have to, or maybe you have a few yogi tasks, that even though you have maybe a half an hour task in a day, it can become quite a monument along the way. So the nature of the mind is it can fill up and complicate and create things. So I have to know the mind, know what it's up to, and know some tactics for its return to the middle path. So the Buddha is talking to his mud-caked buddies who have just been on a long camping trip about this. I mean, he's gone off and clarified his mind. One thing, of course, he does is he does the famous recollection of a moment of peace as a child. He just comes back to, he becomes as a little child once more. And that mind that that child had sitting on the rose apple tree was kind of the right version of the camping trip, sitting pleasantly in the shade, not complex, not overburdened, etc. Freeing the mind enough to just be enjoying the breeze. And so he, in beginning with that moment of serenity and clarity, he solves a lot of his problems by dissolving a lot of his problems. Notice that the beginning of the end of his suffering, the beginning of his long series of mistakes that he's made, is that moment when he decides to dissolve problems. And it is then that he can trust his mind. He also sees it as blameless. He understands that there's no reason to fear this quality, even though it's extremely pleasant to free the mind from its burdens, worries, fears, and extremes that it goes to. It is nothing to be feared. He's very clear about that. Also, he recounts a time as a bodhisattva. I'm not sure that it's all that specific when this was, but where he decides that if he thought only wholesome thoughts, skillful thoughts, and that he does not think unwholesome, unskillful thoughts, and he makes two piles of these thoughts, and he only selects from the pile of wholesome thoughts that he will not regret, he gives it a great whirl, and he comes to the conclusion that this is really good. However, he's still thinking. He's started to divide up the nature of thought, pre-choosing where to go with these thoughts. So he's doing the same thing as the notebook idea, is that you've just discovered that there are certain processes of the mind, they're all thoughts, but they're really to be avoided, really not profitable, they just don't go anywhere, they never give you an accurate description of reality, and they're all suggestive as well. They tend to suggest a direction in which you go. They don't just describe, they prescribe. You got to be careful with the mind. When you think you're describing, you're also prescribing. So he does this, and then further realization comes to him that, yes, this is good, the wholesome thoughts are good, but even this is a bit wearisome, endlessly thinking. And then he proceeds to ask himself, what if I let go of that thinking, but remain conscious, full, indulged in the peace and ease of that? How would that be? And so he just does that, and he discovers that, yes, indeed, that's even better than the endless production of thoughts, even though they're wholesome. So again, he's going towards, this is degrees of samatha. He is not a Buddha at that time. He is a bodhisattva. But he's finding out how to thread his way between these extremes and to find his way. And he's laying down these preliminaries. How he finally gets through it. And this is universal. Every single one of us, if we're ever going to solve our problems, finally have to take this path. We have to understand that we cannot just think, and that we cannot go to extremes, and that we have to, being trapped, even being involved just with wholesome thoughts is not adequate in itself, but there's a marvelous quality in this dissolving of problems. It sets the stage for a kind of evaporation. I would think enlightenment would be more or less something like the evaporation of a puddle of water, where there is no need to dissolve any more, because there is no pool of problems which return. That would be an ultimate situation, ultimate end to the cycle of having to dissolve again and again. So this Dhammacakka Sutta is all about this extraordinary presentation of the Four Noble Truths. And of course it's also presented in the form of a simile, a wheel. The wheel is set rolling. Now the Buddha never, he's foremost, if you, of all the religious literature in the world, they're all full of marvelous parables and similes, some of them just so astute and so perfect. But none of them compare in number and precision to what we find in the Pali Canon in volume. And none of them are offhand, none of them are distorted. And whenever anything like this comes up, one should say that, you know, the Buddha never does anything casually without meaning. It's always amazing what unfolds from it. So when you meditate on Dhamma, think of it as this wheel. What did a wheel mean to what does a wheel mean to you? I mean, what did it mean at the time? The wheel is an astonishing breakthrough in terms of in civilization, really. It's a marvel. It has properties unlike any others. One, and of course, there's a number of places in the suttas where he talks about wheels and how perfectly one can make a wagon wheel and how with these spokes, etc. And the perfection of this rolling motion. And that rolling motion is very part of the faith, is that the processes of the mind, of consciousness, have inertia behind them. And that's very radical. He's saying there's a causal inertia in the structures of the mind. And it is like a wheel. It rolls. It is, if you set it in motion, given the right context, that is the Four Noble Truths, if you understand it in those contexts, a wheel begins to roll. That wheel, he assures us, is unstoppable, ultimately. We just need to get enough momentum behind it, and it inevitably rolls to its liberating conclusion. It happens at a number of levels. It happens at the personal level. It describes the personal consciousness of each individual human being. But also on a larger, grander scale, he's talking about the impossibility that this wheel will be stopped or prevented by any Mara or Brahma or human or royalty or any force on the earth or in the heavens or below. Nothing can stop this wheel when it's set in motion. This is on the grand scale, and of course, that was quite a claim to be making 2,500 years ago, but now from the perspective of how it still is rolling, very palpably, clearly rolling, 2,500 years later, then we say, you know, it's quite amazing that he was accurate with that. The rolling through the fall of empires, rolling through the rise and pass away of huge migrations of people, whole episodes in human history still rolling. It gives one confidence to contemplate that. So far it has proved true. The other part is to take it in personally and to meditate and just internalize that feeling of rolling. There's something beautiful and effortless about the idea of a wheel rolling once it's set in motion. I suspect that because vehicles at the time were pulled rather than self-powered, that many of the similes that the Buddha gave would be different if they were given in modern terms. For instance, the simile for crossing the river to the far side, to Nibbana, is the idea of the raft. So a man gathers some sticks together, binds them together, rests his chest on them, and then kicks with both hands and feet to get himself across this a river. That is the simile of the raft. Often when you hear the raft simile, you imagine something like what Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn rode down the Mississippi River, a kind of a thing with logs and kind of a nice cabin on it. But when you actually read the simile, it's very much poorer than that. It's simply enough to keep your chest and head above water while you get across a river. And of course, what that represents is the four right efforts. The feet, he's very explicit that both feet and both hands paddle in order to do it. And the raft itself, of course, is the Eightfold Path. But it's a poor man's version of it. It's just enough to keep you afloat. That is, you don't have to have memorized the entire Tripitaka or understand all the 37 requisites of the Abhidhamma, etc. You need enough to keep you afloat while you paddle, just to get to the other side. In fact, maybe the Buddha is saying, don't spend too much time making it a glorious raft. It just needs to get you across. People at the time seemed to get across on very simple teachings. It's of course, some people are of great intellect and great memory and so forth, so they seem to absorb the the canon. But others, it's not necessary to be that way, and one should not be intimidated. It's just enough that gives you flotation while you apply effort. But I think if it was at this time, he might have used the idea of a vehicle with wheels, all-wheel drive, four-wheel drive, might have been part of his bag of similes, because the process of right effort, the four right efforts, also lends itself to the idea of the wheel, the powering of all four wheels. And you do need all four. Two of them are to do with negative, unwholesome aspects, and two of them to be positive. So removal and prevention are the two negative, and then sustaining and creating are the two positive. And all of these have to function at certain times. I suppose that once one has attained a certain degree of enlightenment, that the lower two, that is prevention and elimination, I don't need to be exercised. It's just the two positive need to be brought more into it. But before that stage, we need all four. And sometimes at the beginning, we're mostly dealing with prevention and removal. And there can be a little bit of a dry spell before maintenance comes in. There's nothing, sometimes in the beginning of our practice, there's not many wholesome mental states to maintain. They haven't arisen. And by that, of course, is one of the practices to make sure that they come into being, creation of these things. You can think of them as this idea of paddling and kicking, or you can think of them as the flow. I believe that once one gets far enough into the river, it doesn't matter whether you kick and paddle. There's some current that catches you. This would be sotapanna. There's a current that whether you kick and paddle or not, you are destined to arrive on the far shore. And all you really need to do is just to get to that first part of the current that demands that within some few lives, it's inevitable that you be washed up on the far shore. Of course, if you keep up the effort, you get to the far shore quicker, but it's inevitable. If you can just make it into that current, into that stream. And it also ties in with the idea of inertia of the wheel. So that wheels, you know, if we can just start the turning of the wheel. The wheel, of course, has these spokes, as the Eightfold Path is represented in the spokes. The 12 factors of the dependent origination is represented in the spokes. It's all contained, the idea of the path, the wheel, the spokes, all of these things contained in these similes, all wrapped up in this wheel idea. And of course, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is primarily just about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the arising of these light and wisdom and knowledge and freedom and liberation. And of course, for the next 45 years, that wheel keeps rolling, and right to the last sermon. And in all of those talks, the essence of it is also always summarized in that first sermon. It's a remarkable. It's remarkable to look at that over those years, that the initial theme that he sets out, it's like a great symphony. That initial theme is just variation upon variation upon variation, but always fits back into that simple theme of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, rolling inevitably towards light and wisdom and liberation. So I will leave you with those images tonight, and you roll on.
Pandamayam Dhamma Kataya Sadhu Karam Dadama Se
Sadhu.
Welcome.